Tom Shuck. I am an attorney at Taft, Sitinius & Hollister in Cincinnati, Ohio, and have approximately 40 years experience litigating a variety of cases, both general commercial cases and especially in bankruptcy court matters and employment law cases. And based on that, I'm going to talk to you today about some basic rules of the road for federal litigation. The first thing you should be aware of, and this applies no matter how experienced you are, and it applies no matter whether you're the plaintiff or defendant or a third party representative or whatever, you have to know the facts to the extent you can. You should be generally familiar with the law, and it is important to interview your client or clients in advance to assess their veracity and to evaluate whether or not you're going to be out on a limb if you proceed down a road. Federal Civil Rule 11, with which I assume you are all familiar, says that a pleading may not be interposed for improper purposes. Claims and so forth must be warranted by existing law or a non-frivolous argument for the extension, modification, or reversal of existing law, or the establishment of new law. Now, that is a fairly large tunnel through which to drive your litigation truck, but it is not unusual in this extremely adversarial climate to be threatened with a Rule 11 sanctions motion by another attorney. So if you have dotted your I's and crossed your T's in advance, you can say with some degree of comfort, bring it on. And you might want to say, but be aware that the assertion of a groundless Rule 11 motion is itself a Rule 11 violation. So what goes around comes around, and you will find that more often than not, that conversation deters using Civil Rule 11 as a litigation tool. Remember that factual contentions must have evidentiary support. Be sure that your client is being candid with you and provide you with copies of all relevant documents. The worst thing that can happen in a lawsuit is to get down the road and find out either that the client has not been candid or is withholding relevant and usually embarrassing or incriminating information. It's better for all concerned to have that out in front, so that you can decide if you want to proceed and you can give your client a candid assessment of where the client stands. Assuming you're the plaintiff, you'll want to draft a complaint, and Federal Civil Rule 8 governs that. A complaint is a short and plain statement of the grounds for the court's jurisdiction. The claims that you're asserting, including all the elements of each claim, and a demand for relief. You want also to include a description of the parties and a summary statement of the material facts. A complaint is not a substitute for the evidence that will be introduced later, but you will find that it helps the trier of fact, and to some extent it helps your opponent understand what the case is about if you include some basic facts. You want to be aware that the law on what constitutes notice pleading has changed in recent years. So if you are in doubt, err on the side of including information rather than excluding it. Make sure that you have all the bases for federal jurisdiction, be it diversity, federal question, supplemental jurisdiction, what have you. And make sure that you have properly venued your case, that is, the correct district and division. Now, once you've drafted your complaint, you obviously want to serve it. This is Federal Civil Rule 4. The federal system has a streamlined service of process provision which allows an attorney to send out process and the party receiving it to waive formal service. It saves time and money, and among professionals, it's simply a more efficient way to do this. But assuming that you have a recalcitrant defendant, or a defendant that doesn't have counsel, or a defendant that is difficult to reach, review Civil Rule 4 for the variety of other means of serving process, such as using state rules, depending on what state you're in, using an adult process server, using the marshal, and the variety of means that are available if you have to do long arm or foreign process. Hopefully you will get a waiver back under Civil Rule 4D, but if not, you'll have to make sure that you perfect service. If you do not do so within the time provided, the action is subject to dismissal. Be aware under Rule 4K of the limitations, the territorial limitations on service of process. Be aware that proof of service by affidavit can be made. That's where you file something with the court confirming that service has been made. And make sure that your service is perfected within 90 days of filing. That's Civil Rule 4M. Now, if you're the defendant, you have your first significant strategic decision in the case under Civil Rule 12. Do you answer or do you move in response to the complaint? You must do one or the other within 21 days of service, 60 days after request for waiver of service, or 90 days after waiver if the defendant is outside the United States. If you are answering, you want to address each allegation of the complaint. You either deny it, admit it, deny it or admit it in part, or state that you're unable to do so because you lack knowledge or information sufficient to form a belief as to the truth thereof. Remember, Rule 11 applies to all this. Whatever defenses you intend to assert must be asserted in the answer. Some are subject to waiver, some are not. The court's jurisdiction, for example, is not waivable and may always be asserted. But other defenses, and these are outlined in Rule 12, are waivable. So make sure that if they apply, you assert them. I would advise you not to assert frivolous defenses. You see people assert things that are obviously boilerplate. You see people say that they reserve the right to assert any and all other defenses that may come to mind later. That really is not proper pleading. I've never seen a situation where there was a consequence to the lawyer to doing that, but it is not very professional and it doesn't advance the process. So you've got your answer and your affirmative defenses outlined. Make sure you cover failure to state a claim if you believe that's the case. Failure to join an indispensable party, and this is somewhat tricky. You have permissible, necessary, and indispensable parties. That's Rule 13 practice. Take a look at that. It is self-explanatory. It's a little bit murky. But if you think that there's somebody else who has to be in this lawsuit, then you want to preserve that defense. And failure of jurisdiction, obviously, is one you want to assert if you believe it applies. And failure of both subject matter jurisdiction and personal jurisdiction, they are different. If you think either one applies, you must assert it. Now, you may also, at the same time, file a motion under Rule 12. You do not need to if your motion is a substitute for the answer, but be aware. If you move and do not answer, your opponent is entitled then to amend of right to address your motion. So you may want to answer as well as move so that your opponent must then seek leave of court to amend the complaint to address whatever you've raised in your motion. It is a way of bringing issues before the court at an early stage. Civil Rule 12C is a motion for judgment on the pleadings. Typically that will not apply, but if it does apply, it will not apply until after the pleadings are joined, which is to say complaint and answer. But it may be that the complaint simply doesn't set forth a legal basis for relief, so you have to evaluate that. Civil Rule 12D is presentation of matters outside the pleadings. You should not use a Rule 12 motion as a substitute for summary judgment, which we will discuss later. You can attach documents to your motion, but they have to be admissible or self-authenticating, and then the court may or may not consider them. Rule 12E is a motion for a more definite statement. Occasionally you will see a complaint that is so obscure as to be unable to elicit an appropriate response, and that's what that motion is for. And finally, Rule 12F is a motion to strike an insufficient defense or redundant, immaterial, impertinent, or scandalous matters. There is a privilege that applies to court pleadings as to defamation, but pleadings are not intended to be press releases. So if you encounter a pleading that defames your client and really strays from the operative facts, you may want to consider a Rule 12F motion. Now, the first event that will involve you and your opposing counsel in the court is the case management conference. Here you want to look at Civil Rule 16. This is the initial pretrial conference. Different federal judges take different views on how aggressive they will be and how prepared counsel has to be at this initial conference. You want to be prepared to explain your client's case and respond to what you know of your opponent's case. There are a number of things that you and your opponent must initiate together in order to be prepared for your case management conference. The first thing you should address is Civil Rule 26A1. These are initial disclosures. The federal rules of civil procedure are organized in groups loosely related to subject matter, and the discovery rules, so-called, are rules 26 through 37. Each party is obliged voluntarily to offer up the documents that are discoverable and relevant, a list of witnesses and where they are, and are there any insurance policies that apply. And you will see in 26A1 a list of the specific disclosures that you have to make. You should prepare those as soon as the pleadings are closed. Then Rule 26F requires you and your opponent or opponents to agree on a discovery plan. That is essentially a roadmap for the case. It determines what will occur and generally how long it will take to do it and before the case is ready for trial or disposition. So give some thought to what discovery you will need, what discovery your opponent will need, how long it will take to get. Don't forget that written discovery gives the other side 28, 30, whatever days to answer, and that depositions take a while to schedule, and then you have to get transcripts. So don't be in too much of a rush to commit yourself. Rule 16B is the scheduling order. Typically, this order, which is a matter of agreement between the parties and then entered by the court, will govern the course of the action. Different courts have different speeds at which they like to resolve these things. But this is your operative document for the case. At the end of the case, you will have a final pretrial conference. This is the conference that sums up all of the discovery, tells the court how you and your opponent think the case should be resolved. Can it be resolved on a summary judgment motion? Will it require a trial? If so, what kind of trial, to the court or a jury? How long? These are the things that you want to give some thought to as you go along, but be aware that the initial pretrial conference and the final pretrial conference serve as bookends for your case. Finally, be aware that Civil Rule 16F has sanctions provisions for failure to comply with the case management and discovery rules. Be aware of those. Don't get caught short. Now, discovery. We've talked about initial disclosures. Be aware of your obligation to identify and disclose expert testimony. It differs as to testifying and non-testifying experts. A non-testifying expert is basically a consultant, should be a consultant to the lawyer, not the client, and may become a testifying expert later, but initially is not. A testifying expert is someone that you retain with the anticipation that they will provide an expert witness report, which you must exchange with the other side, and in many cases file, and probably give a deposition, and then testify at trial either live testimony or by video testimony in the case of doctors and other experts that are difficult to schedule. So review the expert requirements, determine whether there are issues in your case that require expert testimony. Be aware of the obligation to make pretrial disclosures. Be aware of the scope and limits of discovery, what is fair game and what is not. My advice to you is tailor your discovery to address what are genuinely the issues in the case, because if discovery is seen to be used as a bludgeon rather than a rapier, there can be consequences to that. You will draw a lot of objections, you will increase the cost exponentially, and you may end up in front of a very frustrated judge wondering why you're going into these things. So be guarded as to what you want. Privilege and protective orders. Know that Civil Rule 45 provides protection to non-party witnesses, and Civil Rule 26C provides for protective orders. Don't press the case for clearly privileged information. Now, many times you will get objections that are not well taken, and you'll have to litigate whether information is being withheld legitimately or not. One thing you should insist upon, the rules require it, but not everybody does it, is a privilege log. When you request documents, or in the case of initial disclosures, a privilege log is a list of everything that somebody is withholding on the grounds of privilege. It should identify what the document is, who the author is, who the recipients are, what the subject matter is, what the date is, and what privileges are asserted with respect to it. Ideally, you or your opponent will have pre-numbered documents so that it will also contain a numerical reference. There are two ways to do that. One is to remove the privileged documents from the numerical listing. The better way is to number everything and then list the privileged documents by number so that they appear in their proper sequence, and if necessary, you or your opponent can ask the court to determine whether they are really privileged. And look at Civil Rule 45 as to subpoenas, who you may subpoena, what you may subpoena, and how subpoenas are subject to objection. Use written discovery strategically. Written discovery is interrogatories, requests for production of documents, requests for physical examination, and requests for admissions.
Buckeye CLE's first verification code is FRESH. F-R-E-S-H. FRESH. Buckeye CLE's first verification code is FRESH. F-R-E-S-H. FRESH.
You are limited to the number of questions you may ask. Ask your questions with sufficient specificity that they don't just draw objections as to form. And use admissions sparingly, because it's a rare case that someone will genuinely admit something. Depositions, of course, are recorded statements by witnesses. They're necessary, but they're very expensive. And depending on who you represent, what the issues are in your case, you can spend easily $5,000, $6,000, maybe $10,000 on a deposition, including travel, court reporter time, your time, hotel time, all of that sort of thing. So be aware of what your issues are and whether a deposition is really necessary. It may be that you are able to work out certain issues by stipulation, which saves everybody expense. If not, you will find that you will be in deposition more often than not. Finally, on discovery, full disclosure is the key. You will find that your reputation will prosper. Your client's case will have more respect, and your outcome will improve if you fully disclose all non-privileged information to your opponent and to the court. This avoids unnecessary discovery motions. Every judge hates discovery motions. Some federal judges refuse to hear them. They just say, there are no discovery disputes in my court. You work it out. Or go see the U.S. magistrate. The fewer of those there are, the better off you will be, the happier the court will be with both of you, and the better off you will be with your opponent. If you unfortunately encounter an opponent that is hiding the pee, all you can do is make your record. You have to do it with patience and professionalism. You have to offer to meet and confer regarding disputes. You should not run to the court either haphazardly or precipitously. It should be a last resort, not a first resort. And God forbid, should somebody violate the discovery provisions, take a look at Civil Rule 37. Because you will see that the sanctions can be quite onerous for violating discovery obligations. Now, before we leave discovery, a couple of comments about recent changes to the federal rules. You will see that as of last December, that is December of 15, a number of the rules changed with regard to discovery procedures, particularly with respect to electronic discovery. Electronically stored information, or ESI, is commonly emails, but can be all sorts of data, whatever can be stored. And it is the tail that has come to wag the dog. You want to be careful when you're asking for ESI, because a lot of parties think that the burden of expense should be shifted to the requesting party, and under some circumstances, it might be, unless you can justify the request. So use some discretion in requesting ESI. By all means, ask for it. But be judicious in what you're asking for. Be prepared to work with your opponent on narrowing the requests and providing a protocol by which both your opponent and you can provide that information. Read the revised Civil Rule 34 and the revised Rule 26B, and be aware that these issues will arise during the Rule 26F conference. Take a look at Rule 34-2C, which states that if the producing party asserts an objection to a request for production or ESI, they must state whether any responsive materials are being withheld on the basis of that objection. This goes certainly to privilege, but I suppose might go to a claim of burden, inability to replicate a variety of technical defenses. As you go through, make sure you are looking at the current version of the rule in conducting your discovery. Now, let's assume that discovery is completed. And a word on timing. Discovery can generally be divided into two phases: fact discovery and expert discovery. The court will usually set a schedule for both. Ideally, you will complete fact discovery first. Then the plaintiff will provide an expert witness report based upon the fact discovery and make that expert or those experts available for deposition. The defendant will have a certain amount of time within which to identify his experts, provide their reports, and make them available for deposition. It may be that you believe that at the end of fact discovery, there is a motion for summary judgment that may be appropriately brought, and that the expense of expert discovery is not necessary. If you think that's going to be the case, make the court aware of it at the initial pretrial conference so that there is an opportunity to preclude that expense if a genuine motion based upon the facts is available. Generally, that is not the case. Where experts are required, they're bound up with the facts usually. So let's assume that you've gone through your fact discovery. You've now gone through your expert discovery. Now, both sides have to assess the case and determine whether a motion for summary judgment, either partial or entire, is appropriate. The Supreme Court is more fond of motions for summary judgment as a way of disposing of civil litigation than was the case heretofore. But not all judges are on board with that philosophy, and not all cases are amenable to summary judgment. Having said that, summary judgment is a tool that can be used for different purposes. One purpose might be to educate the judge and the judge's staff about the case, even though you might not really expect the motion to be granted. You should not bring a frivolous motion for summary judgment, but just because you don't think that the motion is a slam dunk is not necessarily reasons not to make the court aware of what you believe the issues are not. That is to say, those that are not in dispute. Summary judgment requires that there be no genuine issue of material fact and that the movant is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. The timing can be under Civil Rule 56 or by pretrial order, and typically it will be by pretrial order. You must support your motion by competent evidence, such as depositions, stipulations, or affidavits. Similarly,